From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in upstate New York, where field crops and cruciferous vegetables are grown. Farmers always have a long list of challenges, starting with the weather, of course, but pest control is also a serious issue. This hour, we're looking at what might be the future of pest control, GMI, genetically modified insects or pests. Specifically, the diamondback moth is a serious problem for farmers not just here, but across several continents. They can wreak havoc on broccoli, cauliflower, and a lot more. But researchers have genetically engineered male moths so that when they mate, they will only produce male offspring. In trials, releasing this genetically modified insect into the population resulted into a crash in the moth numbers within just 2 months. Are there negative consequences to genetically modified pests? And when might this solution be available to local farmers? Well, on Wednesday night at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, the researchers will offer a public presentation on this subject. They're presenting it as Safe Sex for Insects. You can go out on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. in the Albright Auditorium there. But first, they're on Connections, and let me welcome Dr. Tony Shelton, a world expert on the diamondback moth and a professor at Cornell University, who's part of an international working group that was formed to tackle the invasive moth pest problem. Dr. Shelton, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting us, Evan.
And Dr. Neil Morrison is a senior scientist leading the DBM project at Oxford University spin-out Oxitec, and he is with us as well. Dr. Morrison, thank you for being here.
Good afternoon, Evan.
Well, let's start with how this all started. I mean, we know there are invasive insects and pest problems, but Dr. Shelton, Dr. Morrison, how did you end up working on this particular problem? Can you take us through a little bit of the timeline there?
Sure. I think we really need to look at the bigger picture here, and what we're trying to do is to really ensure global food security environmentally responsible way. And we're actually rapidly running out of conventional and organic methods to control a pest like the diamondback moth. We see problems with insects becoming resistant to conventional and organic insecticides. We see the effects of many of these insecticides on pollinators and other organisms. So we really need to step back and think about other ways that we can control this diamondback moth. And like you say, Evan, the diamondback moth is a global pest, damaging crucifers and throughout the U.S., Asia, India, China, and estimated damage is about $4 to $5 billion a year. So that's a lot. And so when we started thinking about other ways of controlling it, we went back to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which she wrote in 1962, and which has been a major influence on my life as an entomologist. And she talked about the other way of moving forward. And one of them, she says, is using sterile insects. And it's a tried and proven method. And it's been incredibly effective for controlling things like the screwworm, which is a pest of cattle. The fly lays its eggs on open wounds and causes a lot of animal suffering and oftentimes death of the animals. So we started looking at maybe what we could do is using sterile insects to also control a pest like the diamondback moth.
Okay. So let's make sure we understand exactly the moth we're talking about here. Can you give us a little bit of a visual description? I mean, our listeners who are listening online can Google it right now, but a diamondback moth looks like what?
Oh, it's the adult is about, think about 3 grains of rice. It's about that big, so it's quite small. But the female will lay about 100 eggs on a crucifer plant like cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, canola, a lot of Asian vegetables. And that female will lay about 100 eggs. Those eggs will hatch into larvae that will feed on the plant for about 2 weeks. Those larvae will turn into pupae, then turn into adults. So if you have each female laying 100 eggs, you can imagine after a couple of life cycles that you basically will have your crop devastated. And it is a worldwide, just a very global major pest. I've had farmers in India and China, as well as upstate New York, have their crops absolutely destroyed by this insect.
Okay, and so before I get to some of our listener questions, and we have a number already who are fascinated by this, we've heard from a couple of farmers who I think they have some concerns to express that you will find common, and I'm sure that you that have come up before. Before we do that, tell me how you've been going about the work and how far along you are. I mean, Reuters and others have had pretty significant headlines about the success of this kind of work. Genetically modified diamondback moth offers pest control hope. And I'm wondering for farmers who want to know how far along you are, you know, give us a sense for just how big a sample of a study you've been doing and what the results have looked like.
Okay, I think I'll let Neil talk.
Yeah, Dr. Morrison, go ahead.
So for several years, we've been working on this strain in lab tests and glasshouse tests. And we recently published a paper in the journal BMC Biology where we described how in glasshouse cage trials, if you release periodically our GM male moths into a cage pest population, that pest population crashes and in the cage crashes to elimination. So this was the first demonstration that releasing our moths into a target population would provide that pest management effect. And the great thing about this method is that because it relies on mating between males and females, it's very species specific. Unlike things like broad spectrum insecticides, which can affect all insects in a field, including beneficial insects like bumblebees. Our method is very specific to the problem pest, and so the ecological footprint is very small.
Okay, and just piggybacking off the point that we heard Dr. Shelton making, you know, Tony, you mentioned silent spraying, and I don't know too many of our listeners who wouldn't have been in my category in grade school or middle school reading silent spraying and thinking about environmental impact. But, you know, we had some listeners before this program even began who thought GMI can't be in that league of environmentally sensitive, right? That there's some sort of, I think, resistance people have to the notion of genetically modified anything. And so, you know, how do you kind of frame it in a way that says this is in the Rachel Carson model, this is environmentally sensitive?
Well, I guess, first of all, I would just quote Rachel Carson. In the last chapter called The Other Road, she says, "The most spectacular of these new approaches is the male sterilization technique developed by Dr. Edward Nippling and his associates." And this is against a screw worm. It worked and continues to work remarkably successfully.
Let me ask Neil then to follow up then how it works successfully, just again for our listener who might not be totally clear on this. The males, mm-hmm. The males can only produce males when they mate, right? And obviously if you only have males being born, you are not going to be able to survive as a species for long.
Well, we're able to release males into the field, and they fly around looking for female mates, pest females flying around in the field. They mate with them. And of their progeny, the females are not able to survive to reproductive age. And so if you release enough of our males over a sufficient period of time in a given cabbage field, the result is that those females can't produce enough offspring and the population reduces drastically. In the factory, we're able to turn off that self-limiting effect by adding an antidote to the diet. And so we're able to breed males and females of this moth. And the antidote isn't available in the field. And so that self-limiting effect takes place.
And the populations have crashed. Go ahead, Tony.
I might just add a point, too. The success of the sterile insect technique with screw worm and a few other species, the problem with that is that they are sterilized through radiation breeding. So when you get a big dose of radiation, it sterilizes them, but it also causes some other potential effects because it affects all the different chromosomes in the insect. So they may not be able to fly as well. They may not be able to compete for mates. So, and you also have to release males and females. So the OxyTech strategy is just using a tweak of the genome. They're able to get it so you just are able to release the males, and those are the ones that are going to be competing with the females in the wild. So it's a advancement on a well-proven technology.
We're talking to Neil Morrison. You just heard Tony Shelton, who's a world expert on the diamondback moth and a professor at Cornell University, and Neil Morrison, a senior scientist that's leading this project at OxyTech, and they're in town, well, they're together, I should say, in town this week for a public talk on Wednesday night at Hobart and William Smith in the Albright Auditorium. The public is invited to that talk as they talk about, you know, kind of the cheeky title being Safe Sex for Insects, but is this the future of genetically modified, you know, is this the way of pest control of the future? And so let me, before I get to some of the listeners' questions, Tony and Neil, you've been talking about how specifically targeted this is for the DBM, for the diamondback moth, and how effective that's been. Is there a reason to think that this kind of approach can work with other pests, or is this limited to this moth?
Well, so this is Neil speaking.
Yep.
We've also developed a mosquito, a strain of the dengue fever transmitting mosquito Aedes aegypti. And we've done a lot of work over the years on that strain, including trials in the field that demonstrate that by releasing our male mosquito into the field, we're able to suppress mosquito numbers to levels far below any other method is able to currently. And so those trials have been undertaken in Central America and South America, principally Brazil, and we've released over 100 million of those mosquitoes so far. And the success really has been unparalleled when compared to other control methods.
Jake wants to know, what about the emerald ash borer problem? Is that a candidate?
I guess, yes, it would be. We just need to think about what's a good pest for a mating-based control. Some insects have a kind of funny reproductive system in which they don't mate at all. So for our method, we need insects to be able to mate with each other. I believe the emerald ash borer does that. We also need to be able to produce it in a factory-type setting, so on artificial diet. And I believe that might be possible for the emerald ash borer, but certainly in agriculture, there are many, many pest insects out there that we can provide solutions to. Agriculture typically relies on sprayed insecticides to manage pests now. And those are either becoming ineffective through resistance, or they're being withdrawn from the market because of environmental concerns and things like that. So farmers are crying out for new methods to be able to control pests in a kind of environmentally sustainable way. And who knows, maybe the emerald ash borer is around the corner.
We're talking about genetically modified insects, and I have to ask our guests if all of the talk in recent years about GMOs has impacted the way the public is responding to your work on GMIs. Tony,
well,
Neil? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I think what we need to do is to look at each technology by itself, and it should stand on its own feet. We're all really on the same side of our desire to try and control pests in an environmentally friendly fashion. And each of these technologies has to be judged on its own merits. And we're still in the exploratory stage of testing the diamondback moth. So far, the results in the greenhouse have looked really spectacular. Now we are doing some cage experiments in the field where we have scaled it up. We're taking one step at a time. I think if farmers are real interested in this technology, they're not going to be able to get it next year. So make no conclusions about that. But down the line, I think the technology holds a lot of promise, just like it did for the screwworm and some other insect pests.
Listeners, if you want to call the program with questions or comments this hour, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Tony Shelton from Cornell University just addressed the fact that it's not going to be this year or next that this kind of solution could be there for the farming community. But Tony, I've heard from a few farmers who did ask that question. Well, how soon are we going to see this? So what is the best case scenario with your work and with what they might be able to have access to?
I wish I could give you a definite answer on that. Research does take a longer time. It's not something that we want to just get out there. We want to make sure that it meets the requirements of growers and the public, and it can actually do its job. As far as concerns about maybe controversy about other biotechnology and maybe if that would spill over into genetically engineered insects, I think we have to take a longer view of it. And if I look back in history and I see, for example, in the early 1900s in the U.S., there was about a 30 to 40% infant mortality from drinking raw milk. Raw milk is kind of like has a lot of microorganisms in it that can be lethal. And so someone had the idea of taking some basic research by Louis Pasteur of just heating up the milk and killing off these microorganisms. And it worked remarkably well. In one study, it went from about 30% infant mortality down to zero in about 1 or 2 years. But there was a lot of controversy in that. If you read the newspapers back then, it talks about it being unnatural. And actually, many of the same claims were made against biotechnology. But if you look at the good that pasteurization has done, and especially, you know, right now in the U.S., we're so concerned about food safety, as we rightly should be, that this technology of pasteurization is now widely adopted. We have to look, I think, in the long term, too. You know, we're experiencing global warming. We're seeing pests now where there never were before. We're also seeing more generations of pests. And so we need to think not only for the present, but for the long term as well. Well, and that's part of our job is working for a land-grant university, which is publicly funded.
Well, in just a moment, I'm going to go to the phones, and Samantha in Dansville, you'll be first up on the question of the long-term impact. You know, Tony, I wonder what you hear from upstate farmers, you know, farmers who are not far from us right now, and what kind of impact this could have on them. I mean, I opened the hour mentioning the kinds of crops, but why don't you remind us what kind of crops are in danger from this kind of a pest and what the impact might be if you're successful here for these farmers?
Okay, so the diamondback moth only affects crucifer or brassica plants. So these are cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, canola, and a lot of Asian vegetables. The cabbage industry in New York is worth about $100 million, so that's a pretty important industry. We've had outbreaks of diamondback moth in the past that are simply not able to be controlled by conventional methods. So yes, diamondback moth is a serious, serious problem.
Yeah, you say you say only. By the way, you just mentioned some of my favorite foods. So these are very commonly grown and very widely. You know, this a huge impact here in Western New York and Neil, not just Western New York, but as we mentioned, across continents. So this is the kind of a cross continent pest, isn't it?
That's right. It affects all the population continents in the world. Wherever vegetables like cabbages are grown, diamondback moth is a problem. And it's particularly a big problem because it so readily develops resistance to insecticides. And so the response in many countries is for farmers to really apply more insecticides to try and counteract the moth numbers. Hmm. And that exacerbates the problem further. In the developing world and elsewhere, farmers are really crying out for new methods, alternatives to insecticides, to offer, I guess, multiple solutions to the pest problem.
Let me get back to the phones. And Samantha in Dansville, first up. Go ahead, Samantha.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
We can. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I just want to ask guys into the conversation late, so I don't know if you've talked about this. But are the scientists really evaluating all the species that are dependent upon these creatures that they're going to eliminate? Essentially, they're taking a piece out of the food chain, and whenever this happens, there's a domino effect. And, you know, you keep fiddling with this stuff, you keep messing with Mother Nature, and she's going to get pretty pissed off. And she is pretty pissed off right now because man's intervention in the natural order of things is disrupting a great number of species, all the way down from tiny little organisms to, you know, the great wolf and any other number of predators out there. So I just want to know, you know, what you plan on doing about this once you let the genie out of the bottle and it cascades some kind of devastating effect, which has happened in the past and I believe will happen over and over again the more we start introducing things that we really don't have a very good understanding of how they work and how they impact other animals.
Samantha, thanks for the call. And just because the connection was sort of in and out, let me just reframe that for our guests and for our listeners. And it reflects what we have a comment from a farmer named Dan online. Dan said, my knee-jerk response is, I don't like this idea. I think of all the animals that eat insects. What happens when you cut food supply? It's like the deer dilemma. It could lead to an interesting and dangerous chain of events. That's what Dan said, and that's essentially what Samantha is saying, which is that, you know, what are the unintended consequences of a genetically modified pest like this? I'm certain that our guests have thought about this, and I think we're eager to hear their response. Well, I'll start with Neil Morrison, and we'll hear Tony Shelton as well. Neil, what do you think?
Sure. So just going to the impact on local ecosystems where this insect might be applied. Because it relies on mating between a male and a female moth, it's very species-specific in action, unlike most other pest insect tools like sprayed insecticides. So used on its own, it has an almost uniquely light ecological footprint. The second point is that the property of the moth is self-limiting. Because females are not able to survive, that property is not able to propagate in the environment. And if you stop releasing, it disappears from the wild. So that self-limiting trait is a really attractive thing that prevents it from persisting in the wild. You stop releasing, it disappears with no trace.
Okay, but also hold on 1 second there, just because I want to make sure I'm clear on this. It when you talk about disappearing from the wild, you know, Tim. Here's Tim on Twitter. Do we know what other parts of the ecosystem are relying on the DBM? Will there be repercussions from removing it? Neil, you're indicating that the answer to that is no. No repercussions. Is that correct?
Well, every action has an effect, but this pest is invasive to the U.S. and most of its range around the world, and so it's not a keystone species for local ecology.
Okay, so when they ask, are there other creatures that are eating the DBM now that would have to eat something else if all the DBM are killed off? That is not a concern, I guess. Or when you say it's an invasive, this is not something that was kind of hanging out here and part of the regular chain. Is that a fair way of describing it?
I think that's a fair way of describing it. And if you don't believe the USDA have examined this as part of the kind of permitting system. And independent experts at the USDA have issued a finding of no significant impact as part of their environmental assessment, which looked at this type of issue that the caller is raising.
Okay. Tony?
Sure. It's, like Neil said, it's an invasive species. And we, you know, it affects the crops that we want to eat, that the farmers are producing. I love working with entomology because they're, you know, they're not Republicans or Democrats. The insects, they don't care if you're rich or poor. They will compete with the crops that farmers try and grow. So what we need to do is to really find the best way of managing the insects in a responsible fashion. We've got a world population that's about 7 billion right now and rapidly going up to 9 billion by 2050. We also have a lot of environmental concerns, pesticides in groundwater, pollinators, making sure that they're healthy. So growers need some new tools in the toolbox, and I think it's our responsibility as scientists to try and explore all the different options. And this sterile insect, diamondback moth, safe sex for insects, whatever you want to call it, that is, I think, a strategy that really has a good potential. And in the long run, I think it's just going to be one of the major tools that we have in our toolbox.
Here's another comment from a different farmer who writes to us, those moths would not be contained to where they would be released, right? They could fly across the road, and I'd be concerned if they end up on my farm. So would the moths that are released with these traits be contained? That's the first question.
I think by and large, the moths would remain on a given crop, but of course, moths have a tendency to fly. I think the main point here is the moths are non-toxic and non-allergenic, and so the consequence of them landing elsewhere, other fields for example, would be negligible.
Okay, because his follow-up there, I think you addressed his follow-up, but I'll read it. He says, I'm not against the science of GM, genetic modification, but he said, I'd be concerned about some of the environmental repercussions, whether it's a plant creating super strains of weeds or in this situation a GM pest. Is there going to be some sort of evolution in this moth that will cause harm? Monocultural agriculture might not want any insects at all, but for some of us, insects can be valuable, and I'm worried that it can impact other species.
Just taking up that point about super crops or another term that the caller used, the difference between GM crops and our insects is that actually we are we're inducing a disadvantage to the moth, and so it's self-limiting in the wild, unlike most GM crops, which confer some sort of advantage, like insect resistance. And so quite the opposite to producing a superbug, we're really producing one that isn't able to reproduce and persist in the field. It's self-limiting.
If you want a chance to hear from our guests today, they are going to be presenting on Wednesday night at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. It's a public talk. Is safe sex for insects and maybe the future of pest control in this country and around the world. Hobart and William Smith hosting that event. It's a free public event at 7 p.m. Wednesday night in the Albright Auditorium. And you're invited if you want to go out and check that out. We're going to get to more of your questions coming in. Diane with a question on comparing pesticides to antibiotics in people and why she thinks this sounds like a great idea. So we'll get Diane's question next. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255, with Dr. Tony Shelton, who is a world expert on the diamondback moth and a professor at Cornell University, who's part of that international working group formed to tackle the invasive moth pest problem, and Neil Morrison, a senior scientist leading the project at Oxford University's spinoff Oxitec. Your questions and more coming up next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, puzzle master Will Shortz joins us in the first hour. He's the editor of the New York Times crossword, among many other talents, and he will delight our audience in preview of an upcoming visit here, no doubt about that. And then, second hour, we're talking to cultural critic Gerald Early about neighborhoods and race. We'll talk with you on Tuesday.
Imagine a table and chairs 3.5 times normal size. Now imagine being under that table and chairs at a new museum of post-war and contemporary art in Los Angeles.
We sit at tables to eat our breakfast or do our homework, but here we are underneath one.
Talking about art to kids at the Broad. That's coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You've heard of GMO. We're talking GMI, genetically modified insects, this hour. And the question of the diamondback moth, which is a big problem as a pest for farmers who are growing things like broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and more. Problem not just in upstate New York, but really around the world, to the tune of hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year. And some of the work that's being done is through our guests for this hour. They've done work that essentially limits the way these moths can propagate and can crash populations within a couple of months, but in a way that aims to be environmentally friendly and much better than sort of elevating the use of pesticides. So for our guests, I want to read some comments from one of our listeners named Diane, who sent a lengthy email, but she wanted to just ask you to expand on the point about how we use pesticides. She said they raise an important point. Sometimes when something seems to work and its efficacy drops, we use more of it. Think about antibiotics in human beings. We know that antibiotics are overused, and we create superbugs that way. You've had medical professionals on your program talking about this very issue. I don't know if it's a perfect comparison, but in regards to pesticides, the last thing we need is simply to increase the dose. Can your guest talk a little bit more about that and give us more of a sense of how pesticides are used in the farming world and how that could be changing? That's from Diane. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Okay, this is Tony Shelton, and the strategy that we actually try and employ for managing insect pests is really something called integrated pest management, where we, you know, just because it's Tuesday, you don't go out there and spray. What you do is you try and prevent the insects from coming in by using some landscape practices. You encourage biological control. You use host plant resistance. You use a lot of integrated technologies. One of those integrated technologies, I think, can be this safe sex for insects. Because again, what you're trying to do is to not get to the point where you have to get into a pesticide treadmill. You want to lower the pest population so it's not damaging. You're never going to eliminate the pest population, because for diamondback moth, for example, it feeds on a number of other weeds and then can move back into the field. But what you want to do is to prevent the damaging high population. So this, in fact, is a really ideal way. Let's say a grower has a early season infestation. What are his or her choices? Well, I can spray a pesticide, insecticide. That might take care of the problem, but you're also going to have some of those insects being able to survive and develop resistance to that, so you'll have to come back again and again. The sterile insect technique actually gives a bit of an alternative to that, and you can just lower the pest population, and so you're not going to have to continue to apply so many pesticides. So I think that would be one way that we can approach the problem.
Well, we've had a number of questions about pesticides as well. Mark writing, haven't pesticides become safer over the years? And so I want to hit a couple of points, what you were just talking about, Dr. Shelton. You know, for example, the diamondback moth, if I heard you correctly earlier this hour, you said that it is sort of particularly resistant to pesticide. Is that accurate?
So in the scheme of things, of most wanted insects that have evolved resistance to insecticides, it's number one. But the caller is correct that many of the newer insecticide chemistries are much, much safer. But, you know, what we want is just a combination of different strategies. This particular sterile insect technique, it only affects diamondback moth. It doesn't affect pollinators. It doesn't affect predators and parasitoids of insect pests. So it's more specific than any insecticide that I can come up with.
Okay, and Dr. Morrison, what do you make of Diane's comparison of antibiotics in humans and creating superbugs and resistant strains to an overuse of pesticides in farming? Is there a parallel, or is that not the best comparison?
No, I think there are parallels. If a farmer or a doctor were to rely on just one tool to solve a problem, biology will find a way around it. In insects, the insects develop resistance to a given insecticide. And so, as Tony says, you need multiple tools enabled to provide protection against that happening, but also to be able to farm smart, I guess, and to be able to produce food in an environmentally friendly way.
We get back go ahead, Tony.
I'd add one more point to that. So we want our farming systems to be sustainable, and we want them to have resilience. So eliminating the key pest, or not eliminating it, but controlling or managing the key pest of diamondback moth, that allows the beneficial insects to flourish. And so if other insect pests come in, you still have those natural enemies that are able to knock out some of those other pest species. But we also have to remember too that, you know, we have a population that needs to be fed, and it's a population that's growing, and we have global warming that's occurring. It's going to exacerbate many of the pest problems we have. We need new strategies to be able to control insects.
I want to remind our listeners that our guests are joining us via the WEOS studios at our partners down at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. It's 89.5 FM in the Finger Lakes, and we hope if you're in the Finger Lakes, you're listening every day at 89.5 FM, Finger Lakes Public Radio, and the great work at WEOS. Such a great crew down there, and we're proud to be partners with them. So that's where they're joining us from. Let's get back to the phones, and this is Bud in Chilai. Go ahead, Bud.
Hey, I've got 2 points to make. One is that the callers who think we're messing around with nature is a big problem. Well, my question would be, how do you suppose we got the hybrid cauliflowers and broccolis and collard greens and all those things which we now depend on? It was messing around with nature, and it was, so this is a history of man in that respect. The other question I really had was this. Can you apply this type of technology to the codling moth, which is so destructive to fruit trees?
The codling moth and fruit trees. Go ahead, Neil.
So we have done a bit of work on the codling moth in the past, and it could be a very, very suitable pest for us. At the moment, there's a sterile insect technique program operating in Okanagan in Canada, in which they irradiate moths and release them into the field, and it's effective, but maybe not quite as efficient as it could be. And so our genetics could really make that much more efficient and make it more applicable to a kind of wider range of settings. Codling moth is a big pest, and I think our method would work well against it.
I'd like to compliment that caller in, because that's absolutely right. You know, hybrid crops are absolutely essential, not just in the U.S., but throughout the developing world. You know, even in little villages that I visit in India or Bangladesh, majority of farmers use hybrid seed. That's created through man's intervention.
We've had a number of comments about that this hour, and I didn't want to make the hour sort of bogged down by the GMO questions and comments. We've talked about it on this program in the past, but suffice to say, I will sum up a lot of the feedback we're getting from our listeners from an email from Mike, who says, "Are your guests driven nuts by the hysteria about GMOs?" You want to take a stab at that, Tony?
I think I'll defer to Neil on
that.
Go
ahead, Neil.
then I'll follow up.
I think the important point here is we're all on the same side. So I don't think you'll find anyone who wants to produce food in a way that's not environmentally sustainable or safe to people. So from that respect, we're certainly coming at it from the same direction. And I would, you know, my approach would be to just look at new technologies on a case-by-case basis and look at the benefits they can provide. And, I certainly believe in our approach, or I wouldn't be working on it. I only have positive things to say about the potential environmental benefits of what we do.
So the question, I think, is, you know, do scientists get frustrated by the negative comments about biotechnology? And certainly, I think there's a great deal of frustration. you know, we can come up with a new technology. For example, sweet corn, you know, which we love in upstate New York, especially around, you know, the 4th of July holidays. There is sweet corn that has been engineered to be resistant to insects, and it simply has a bacteria. It expresses a bacterial protein, and this same bacterial protein has been used by organic farmers for 70 years. Well, when it was put into sweet corn and we looked at it, we had perfect sweet corn with no insect injury and no supplemental sprays. To me, that was remarkable compared to conventional corn, sweet corn, which you may have to spray, you know, 3 to 7 times during the season. So yeah, when we see a technology that really works well, we do hope that it gets adopted. And we also know the consequences for if it's not adopted.
We're talking about not GMO this hour, though, GMI, a certainly related field, genetically modified insects, and perhaps the future of pest control. I've been talking in specific about the diamondback moth, which is a big problem for farmers here and around the world. Farmers who grow broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, and more. But this approach, a genetically modified insect, could be a significant part of the future of pest control. And that's what we've been talking about with our guests for the hour. And Paul writes to us, Evan, fascinating subject. Thanks to your guests for taking it on. I'm curious if they can elaborate on how global warming is making this more challenging. And I think, Tony, he's responding to something you said just a few minutes ago. So go ahead, Tony.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons that we're doing this experiment in upstate New York is, well, diamondback moth is a significant pest to our growers in this area, but it also does not overwinter at present. But we know that in the future, it will. And so it's will become more and more of a problem. I should also step back and say, back in 1990, when I was working in Southeast Asia, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does some sterilization of insects for these management programs, it was trying to do something with diamondback moth back then through radiation breeding. So I was looking over that project and talking with people about it and examining the ecology of diamondback moth in that area and whether this irradiated insect could actually really work well. And it simply couldn't. This radiation sterilization is pretty harsh. And, you know, the insects were not developing well, they were not flying well. So the idea of being able to genetically engineer the insect by just tweaking a few of its genes, this works well, or so far, at least in our evaluation, the greenhouse. I think, Evan, you mentioned it took 2 or 3 months to crash. We didn't really see it 2 to 3 months. We saw it just about a month. Diamondback moth can turn over a generation in about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so just the introduction of these insects will just cause the population to crash fairly readily.
Okay. Neil Morrison, how do you respond to questions about the impact of climate change?
I think it's well known that global climate's just getting warmer, and so in latitudes such as upstate New York or where I live in England, climate's getting warmer, and so insects that might have just be summer visitors at the moment, in a few years' time actually will be resident year round. And it's in situations like that where insects are able to reproduce around the world when they really, really become a big problem. And diamondback moth, it goes through multiple generations in tropical countries, and that's when it becomes particularly difficult to control.
Go ahead.
And this technology of sterile insect, I mean, you're not going to apply it to monarch butterfly, mm-hmm. or some very, very valuable insects. It's going to be applied to insects that are pests. So it has a specific focus.
Okay. Jake writes to us, this might be a bit out there, but what about engineering a super predator that's similarly genetically sterile with a short lifespan? Good idea or too much of a risk? Might be more generally useful.
Well, he sounds like a good applicant for the entomology program at Cornell. So.
Drop me
an email note.
Jake is one of the most intelligent routine listeners we have, and he's always thinking outside the box. But the question of creating a super predator or engineering a super predator, is that a non-starter?
It's not something I've thought of. a super predator conjures to mind some kind of giant tiger, but it's certainly not something we're approaching at the moment. But I guess you've got to let science take its course. And so if there's anything with promise out there, why not just let science look at the possible benefits?
All right. Well, and to Jake's point there, I would think if you engineer a super predator, whether it's for this moth or whatever it is, then you really are in the business of unintended consequences, and the monster is out on the street at that point. Well, Allison writes to us and says, my family has been in farming for years, and I am an optimist that what you've been talking about today could be a major, major breakthrough for people who have been in this business. But I'm also wondering, do they see any possible negative unintended consequences? It doesn't sound like they do. That's from Allison. Go ahead, gentlemen. Neil or Tony?
what we're doing is we're evaluating this first in the greenhouse, then in cages in the field, and then in the field. So we're taking this on a step-by-step basis. So this technology that's very, very species-specific, we see many, many advantages. We also have to compare it to what the alternatives are. And anytime someone says, well, you can't use that technology or we don't agree with that technology, we need to look at what it's compared to. And we see continuing problems with the conventional and organic agricultural systems that we have. So what we want to do is to offer a technology that will really have the least negative impact.
Yeah, I guess seeing as I've had a bit of time to ponder, I think the fact that it's self-limiting, so it's not able to persist and survive in the wild, means that actually you need to keep supplementing numbers of our male moths in the field as you go. I guess economically you might want to just release your insect and just let it do its work all season. But actually with our technique, you might have to release once a week for several weeks for it to have its beneficial effect. And of course, once you stop releasing, the insect disappears from the wild. It's not able to persist. So you can't have it all, I guess.
Okay. Amber writes to us and she says she's still a skeptic on this. And she says, I have to tell you that my heirloom organic broccoli and cauliflower plants are not plagued with pests, nor are my other plants. Is that too small a sample size, or is there a reason that she has not had a pest issue that you would be able to sort of alight on, Tony?
Well, I'm glad that she hasn't had the pests in her garden. I presume that this is a fairly small garden. And actually this year, because of all the rains, we've had reduced caterpillar populations. Next year, if it's hot and dry, I hope she can say the same thing. But, you know, a small backyard garden is a lot different than the larger commercial fields that are, you know, that we get much of our produce from. So good luck, and, you know, I hope things work out well. But controlling insects on a small backyard garden, like what I do in my home, is a heck of a lot different than a commercial agricultural field.
We've been talking genetically modified insects and pests for the hour with my guest, Tony Shelton, who you just heard. He's a world expert on the diamondback moth and a professor at Cornell University, and Neil Morrison, a senior scientist leading the Diamondback Moth Project at Oxford University spin-out Oxitec. And you can listen to their public talk this Wednesday night, 7 p.m. in the Albright Auditorium. 7 p.m. That's on the Hobart and William Smith campuses. And Neil, what's your quick preview? What are you going to be talking about? I mean, we're going to be talking about a lot of what we heard this hour, but what's the preview for what's coming up on Wednesday night at 7?
That's right. So I guess we want to just provide more explanation of how our approach works. Also, Tony will be talking about what diamondback moth does, the kind of damage it causes to pests, and also maybe explain some of the experiments we have done, talk about the field cage trials underway at Cornell University at the moment, and also be able to answer anyone's questions who's in the audience.
Thanks for taking the time. And Neil, I know there's been a lot of travel involved. Thanks for taking the time to come on the program and engage with our guests today on this subject. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And Tony Shelton from Cornell University, I'm sure we'll be in touch as your work continues on this project. You've had a lot of interest from the farming community this hour, and I look forward to future conversations. Thank you, Tony.
Great. Well, and also for your listeners, I would recommend that they actually go back and read the last chapter of Silent Spring, because I think it'll, we're trying to do the right thing, and many of Rachel Carson's points are really appropriate.
I recall reading it in school, and a revisit would be worthwhile. By the way, Neil, where can people go online to find out more about Oxitec?
So our website address is www.oxitec.com. For diamondback moth, just add a slash and a DBM. You can also see us on social media at Oxitec. And if you have any questions you'd like to ask directly, write to the email address dbmtrial@oxitec.com. All questions welcome.
And Oxitec is OXITEC. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks to our crew again down there at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, WEOS 89.5 FM in the Finger Lakes. And if you're in the Finger Lakes, I hope you remember down there. They love the support and they need it from our great community there. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Connections.